Welcome to the Dialogue by Wirepoints, connecting the dots between our economy, government, and people. And now your hosts, Ted Dabrowski and Mark Glennon.
Hello and welcome to the Dialogue from Wirepoints. I'm Ted Dabrowski and with me is Mark Glennon, my partner in crime. And today our topic is inflation. Inflation is at a 40-year high and it's having an impact on in all kinds of ways. Some things that are related to, of course, it's national, it's impacting everybody. Some things that are maybe a little bit more Illinois specific that we want to touch on. But, you know, we haven't talked about inflation in decades in this country. And the most recent numbers showed that inflation is up 7.5% year over year. And that's kind of an average of a basket of goods. Different products are up in different ways or different amounts. But, you know, we haven't talked about inflation in forever because inflation has been low since the 1980s. And, you know, usually in the last three decades or four decades, prices have gone 2% a year. Salaries have tended to keep up with that, maybe exceeding that for the most part. So people, you know, haven't been hurt by inflation and they haven't seen the nastiness that inflation can bring. And, you know, I was just a small kid back in the 70s when inflation hit. And I remember the, you know, the OPEC, cutting supplies and gas prices spiked. And I remember the lines of cars. I didn't really understand inflation then, right? But I remember that impact. But since then, it's like been nothing and until now. And prices on everything are rising. They're going up much faster than wages. And it's kind of a way to think about inflation is like a pay cut. Prices are rising much faster than people's wages. And so they're getting pay cuts. A good way to look at this is think about somebody on a low income right now. You know, food and gas and heating your home, those are going to eat up most of your income in general. And you've seen some of those things spike. You know, here's some of the recent numbers. These are the year-on-year increases. Beef up 16%, eggs up 13%, gasoline up 40%, your utilities up 24%. I mean, people are going to get crushed by that. Some people are going to get crushed.
Ted, so, I want to see the number on bourbon. I think, as I told you, there was a special problem with bourbon because they thought at the beginning of the pandemic they weren't going to have much demand from restaurants, and also they cut down their aging process substantially, and that's led to a shortage. And I think it's an acute problem myself. So,
damn, Mark. I mean, that's a key one that I think a lot of people care about. Man. So let's back up a little bit and back. Why is this issue so important? Why are we talking about this at Wirepoints? You know, this isn't a Illinois specific issue per se, although we'll tie it in. But, you know, why is it a big deal? We got elections in November. And we also need to understand how inflation will not just push up the price of beef and bourbon, but how it ends up hitting property taxes and your home values and things like that. So we'll come back around to that. So, Mark, why don't you kind of kick us off a little bit about just kind of a broad step back on inflation and why this is happening now?
Yeah, there's a few key reminders that we should take note of from that experience in the 70s. Some of you may have forgotten these points, and some of you, many of you, most of you probably don't remember it. The hyperinflation of the 1970s is normally attributed simplistically today to the energy price spike. After the 1972 war, between Israel and Egypt, there were OPEC imposed an oil embargo. Prices shot up drastically for energy. That was indeed the primary driver of inflation. However, and this is pointed out very well by Jeremy Siegel, a very notable current economist, Ted, from your alma mater, Wharton, who cataloged how that fed on itself. And businesses became greedy. They built inflation into their prices and more. Some unions became greedy. Same thing, building inflation into their contracts and more. So inflationary expectations took hold. Both parties were very generous with federal spending, leading to huge deficits. And that drove up prices as well, leading to what Siegel describes as the biggest policy failure since World War II. So we don't have in common that energy spike. You know, they called it cost push inflation at the time. But we do have a severe risk of some of these other things taking hold. And, you know, it's important to remember why inflation is bad. You know, at first reaction, you might say, well, you know, these are generalized price increases. Everything changes. You're just redenominating the currency. Wages go up, prices go up. Nothing really changes. Not true, because, you know, it's first of all, it's extremely hard on the poor and working class. The percentage of their income that they have to spend on consumption is far higher than wealthier people. People on fixed incomes, of course, are hammered. And businesses trying to plan out what their prices are going to be. You know, an essential step, if I'm going to build a new plant to build bicycles, I need to know how much I'm going to be able to sell the bicycles for, but you don't really know. And indeed, it's the fluctuations in the rate of inflation that can be as much trouble as inflation itself. The Fed had earlier targeted a steady 2% inflation rate. Had they been able to achieve that, that might have been fine. But it's now not only high, but erratic, and that causes problems. It particularly causes problems for international suppliers. Ted, you experienced this. I know you were working abroad when some of those other economies experienced inflation, and it really wreaks havoc with any kind of planning and the functioning of markets. So this is more than just a headache caused by, and we're going to get into the causes here. There are many causes of today's inflation. Some are beyond control. The disruption in the supply chain is not entirely government's fault. The pandemic, of course, shut down things. The shutdown, the rules, the mandates, you know, has caused a spike in inflation. But the biggest driver, and I think there's widespread agreement about this, is this astonishing flood of cash from the federal government and from the Federal Reserve Bank, which creates money out of thin air. That has totaled some $13 trillion, I think is the number now, about almost $4 billion of which is that money from thin air from the Federal Reserve Bank. And, you know, they've been working, the Federal Reserve Bank, unfortunately, has been working hand in hand, joined at the hip with the Treasury Department on this, which is very troubling. That Henry Kaufman wrote an article about this a year ago. He was one of the granddaddies of inflation knowledge going back to the 1970s. And he really lamented the fact that there's no true independence anymore from the Federal Reserve Bank, and they've been the great enabler of all this federal spending.
You know, the big issue, and you mentioned, is all these trillions. And, you know, we've written about it. We've talked about it here. You know, the COVID was, you know, just an exogenous event that hit everybody, hit worldwide. And so, you know, I would still critique any kind of, you know, massive spending by the federal government, period. But maybe, you know, maybe some people will say, okay, the CARES Act, which is the first, you know, first big round of money. Okay, maybe that was needed. And, you know, at WirePoints, we looked at the CARES Act and how much money went to state and local governments, for example. We looked at the reserves that states and local governments had to weather the storm. And, you know, we had concluded that, gosh, that was enough overall. That was enough to get states and local governments back into normalcy, let's call it, with regard to revenues. And, you know, we said, hey, this next round of money, which, of course, came after Biden became president, you know, the massive trillion spent again, was going to be, one, unnecessary, and two, inflationary. You just can't have all that money in people's pockets, you know, people making more in unemployment than when they were working. I mean, you know, people were making more money. And so all these trillions of monies have found their way into, you know, more demand for goods and pushing it up, while at the same time you had the risks of COVID, the problems of COVID, supply and problems. And so you had a demand effect. I mean, sorry, a supply effect. You had more demand with people having money. And it's not unsurprising that we've gotten to this level. And here we are.
And it has inflated not just consumer prices, but asset prices, again, which primarily benefit the rich. The poor don't have many assets like houses or holdings in cryptocurrencies or the stock market. The stock market had a fantastic run up until a few months ago. House prices have gone through the roof across the nation, not so much here in Illinois, but that has priced new families out of the market. All this money going into cryptocurrency and things like that, that money found its way from, you know, the Federal Reserve Bank. Astonishingly, the Federal Reserve Bank is still buying, I think it's $40 billion of bonds. And, you know, that's that money created per month. They had been buying mortgage securities, you know, which is basically a subsidy for the housing market, mortgage securities at the pace of $30 billion a month up until recently. Well, that's just insane. That just drove up housing prices, benefited people that already owned homes, but didn't help the poor and working class at all.
Ted, I just
call you out because you wrote that detailed article back in, I think it was April, about laying out in detail why the states and localities didn't need that money beyond what the CARES Act had already paid them. I wrote in May about the inflationary troubles that would come from the Federal Reserve Board. I was hardly alone, no prescience there. But, you know, this was coming like a steam train, full speed ahead with its lights on at us, and the Federal Treasury and the Federal Reserve Bank ignored it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the story of so many things where the facts don't matter and the truth doesn't matter. You know, when we add it up, it's a pretty easy thing to do. If you added up what the revenues were of you know, state governments before COVID, and then you just added in CARES Act money, and then you added up the reserves they had, and it was kind of an easy math thing, right? Some states, a few stayed behind. Most states were well ahead. But you look now, and we've talked about this, the states are flooded. I mean, they're flooded with cash. They don't know what to do with it. In Illinois, of course, has bigger problems, but you're talking about record budgets, record spending. So it was an easy one to see. One thing I wanted to add to, Mark, was how behavior changes. And I don't think this gets enough attention where, I was living in Mexico for 6 years, and I was there when they had their, what's called the tequila crisis, 1994. And they had eventually a massive devaluation of the currency, which of course led to massive inflation. And, you're talking about a place like Mexico where, inflation, really, we're talking about real inflation there, right? Really nasty stuff. And, it made a lot of people poor in a matter of days. I was lucky. I was paid in dollars. I was, in banking, so I got paid in dollars. I didn't get the impact. I actually had dollars to spend and could buy more. But what it really does is when you have bigger inflation, it changes how people think about things. You think less about productivity and what's the right thing. When there's no inflation, you do what's right. You think about productivity. You invest in things. You can project, like you said. When there's inflation, you have to say, maybe I'm better off buying things that inflate. And so I'm going to look at financial assets, or I'm going to look at, assets that are hard assets that will hold their value. And you might stop thinking about production because maybe production becomes riskier. So it really changes the dynamics of things. And I remember being down in Mexico, and, what you do is you buy hard assets. You don't want to hold your currency if it's going to lose value. You buy a washing machine. You buy things that you can sell later that will hopefully inflate because it has an inherent value rather than financial assets, which might lose their value. So it does crazy things to economies, and it does crazy things to people's behavior.
And that's a vicious cycle because more spending, where people rush out to buy things before prices go up, that only drives prices up further. Ted, there's one other horror from the 1970s that we need to worry about before we move to applying this to Illinois. And that is ultimately the remedy that the federal government turned to was super high interest rates just to crush the economy. I think it was excessive, but Paul Volcker took over at the Federal Reserve Bank. Interest rates went up to 20%. Inflation rate reached as high as almost 14%. So they went way overboard. That meant real rates were some 6%, which is very high by any standard. But that stopped inflation because it stepped on the economy. You could stop inflation too. If you went around and shot every fifth person, you know, that would slow down the economy and you contain inflation. That's what the government had to resort to. And if this gets out of hand, if inflation doesn't abate, it's a very difficult thing to predict, by the way, but if it does, if it doesn't abate, we should be concerned that as a last resort, we'll return to those super high interest rates that devastated the economy. I mean, the stock market went down 55% over the course of 20 months at one point there. And the Federal Reserve didn't take the brakes off on that and loosen up on interest rates until 1982. And that began a bull market that essentially lasted for another, 38 years. So there's a lot to worry about here.
Well, I think, just when you remind me, and I remember, of course, being in school and studying that, those 21% rates and things like that. I mean, can you imagine that? That's what brings it to reality. Imagine having a mortgage that's in the, high teens or whatever the number would have been at the time versus, we've had mortgages. I think I got a mortgage at 299 recently or something like that. So 2.99%. Those are phenomenal numbers. And it can kind of help you understand how messed up and how skewed the market gets.
Yeah, I had just started out practicing law in the early 80s, and interest rates are so high that they were exceeding the usury rates in many states. So, ordinary bank rates, credit cards, commercial finance, you were hitting what could be criminal usury laws.
Mark, one of the things that we were talking about was that, once things like inflation come out, everybody comes out to blame other people, and it gets really messy, right? Because it is a complex phenomenon. You got union costs, like labor. It doesn't have to be a union; it can just be employees, people who say, "Hey, my wages are being eaten up by inflation. I want more money." And that could be, that could be Joe Blow. It could also be a union. But you start to get everybody blaming other people, big companies. What talk about some of the politics on that, because I know you follow that.
Well, unfortunately, the Biden administration has turned to blaming different business groups. Initially, they claimed that beef producers, which there's a limited number of large ones, I think it's five that kind of dominate the industry, were being the bad guys, including on prices to drive up prices. He has since also blamed grocery store chains for being greedy. I think he said something about the auto industry. I don't think there's any basis to that. If any of those things were true, why didn't we hear anything about it before this inflation kicked in? Why didn't they do anything about it before inflation kicked in? And it's kind of been dropped since then. I think it was a pretty transparent attempt to blame somebody for a government problem that the government itself caused at this point. And this was not caused by colluding companies or anything in the private sector, to my knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, you make a great point, right? Why wait till today? They could do it anytime in theory. And certainly, if you think about it, economy's locked down, people are at home. If people weren't getting these massive stimulus checks and the bailouts coming to states, if anything, companies were going to go broke because people in theory would have been poor. So, it has to be a phenomenon, at least partially, of people having tons more money to spend. And you can see it. You can see it in the government revenues, right? If you look at the income tax revenues for Illinois, the sales tax revenues, the capital gains tax revenues, the state is making tons of money. And that, again, is a reflection of just tons of money being in the system.
Well, Ted, the wages are going to go up. Somebody's going to claim. And Governor Pritzker has given everybody a big, tax break that's totals $1 billion. Do you think that's going to take care of them and make them whole?
Yeah, that's, he's tried to send a message. Again, here we are flooded with money in the short term. And again, remember, this is just a short term situation where we have these bailout dollars. So he has offered what he said, listen, for all these pains of inflation, I want to help Illinoisans by temporarily suspending. There's a 1% grocery sales tax in Illinois. So he wants to suspend that for a year. There's a upcoming 2-cent increase on the gas tax, which now becomes, there's an automatic gas tax increase every year based on inflation. So inflation, these 2 cents, he wants to postpone that or freeze that starting in July. And he also wants to give a discount on property taxes. And the problem with all that is, first of all, you know, a 1% grocery sales tax relief. Well, I just told you what beef was, 18% or what is it, 16%. And you know, you've got the massive increases on everything else. So, all right, 1%, whatever. Of course, you take it, but that's not serious, right? It's not a serious reform. It's not a serious help for people. But all right, the 2 cent on gas tax, again, that's not like a cut in the gas tax rate. This is a postponement or a freeze of one. And let us remind people that in 2019, Illinois doubled its gas tax from 19 cents to 38 cents. And we also have a sales tax on gases on gas. So as gas prices have gone up, so has a sales tax. So we've had a massive increase. So 2 cents doesn't do much. And I want to talk a little later about this whole property tax. That's a specific thing. But yeah, this is not the real relief that people need in Illinois. It's
a gimmick. Yeah, the bottom line you wrote about, Ted, tell us what the numbers are comparing what inflation has cost the average consumer versus what they would get out of this tax break proposed by Pritzker.
Oh, yeah. Right. So if you look at this, you know, the Wall Street Journal came out and said that the average U.S. family is going to spend an additional $276 a month. All right. So we said, all right, there's 4.86 million families in Illinois. So basically, in a month, they're going to spend $1.34 billion more overall. Well, Pritzker's only offering $1 billion relief for a full year. So in other words, said differently, because there's a lot of numbers there, the relief that Pritzker's offering will be wiped out in about 3 weeks. That's it.
3 weeks worth of inflation relief. Yeah. Okay, 3 weeks, that's the bottom line. And, you know, that $200-some a month, you know, you and I and a lot of our listeners bitch and moan about that, but that's devastating for countless families that live hand to mouth. They just don't have another $230 or something to spend on groceries and everything else. You know, all these policies were cheered on by progressives. I mean, the support for this came out of progressive states and progressives in Congress. And it's just yet another example of the counterproductivity of progressives who claim to be helping the poor and working class, and they're in fact screwing them. There's just no other way to say it. Many people are saying this is turning out to be the largest wealth redistribution in history in favor of the rich. That's sure true. It already is true in terms of those assets prices that I've said are already inflated, and now it's hitting consumers directly in the pocket.
Yeah, you know, just to put some numbers on that. We said the inflation was about 7.5% in the last year. But if you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics and their numbers, and you then look at, you know, wage growth and all that, overall in that one year period, through December, latest numbers, is that on average, hourly earnings are down 2.4%. So rather than people having a raise, having worked for a year and hopefully being more productive and all that, and to capture and to help them with inflation that normally comes, they're down 2.4% after a year. So, and again, that's a big average. You know, that $276 a month that the average household is spending. It's a lot different when you start thinking about the low-income family that has to drive far to get to their jobs. So they're going to get hit more by gas and things like that. So the number can actually be even bigger for a lower-income worker.
You know, one thing that's being lost in this debate, too, the debate is over whether inflation will be transitory. That's the word always used by the administration. And many economists believe that inflation is going to abate because the pandemic will go away. The supply chains problems will eventually go away and inflation will drop with it. But let's suppose that inflation drops to zero. That doesn't mean you got that inflation back. You're still 8% behind where you were 12 months ago. Let's hope there's not deflation because that would cause other problems, but you know, you're not getting this money back that came from inflation. And the bigger concern, of course, that is that it's going to create inflationary expectations and feed on itself, as we described that it did in the 1970s.
Yes, and Mark, you know, some people might say, "Hey, why are we mentioning Pritzker and all this and his relief?" I think we have to make sure we tie back your point about, you know, there are several states that were begging for the bailouts, and who had very strict COVID policies. So the more that Illinois locked down, the more that it wanted more bailouts, because by definition, we're shutting down our restaurants, our bars, you know, all kinds of companies. So, you know, that helped the argument that, well, we needed even more stimulus checks and bailouts. And so when you look at who the leaders were of calling for bailouts, and who were the leaders of having the strictest lockdowns, is some of the big states like Illinois, California, New York, New Jersey. And those are specifically the ones that wanted the money. So Governor Pritzker, you know, Senator Don Harmon, right when COVID broke out, he made his $42 billion request right off the bat to Illinois' congressional delegation, saying, "We need a bailout." And it was fascinating that he made that request so quickly and so publicly. And of course, the New York Times, as we've talked about, you know, wrote about it and said, you know, Illinois asked for $42 billion bailout, or whatever the title was. So they're implicated in this, Mark.
Ted, we had that story out about 10 minutes before the New York Times did, actually. So let's give credit where credit is due. But you're right. It became a national story that Illinois could attempt to be so greedy. That was $42 billion just for the state that they wanted. They ended up getting somewhere between 8 and 14, depending on how you count it, which was far more than needed to compensate them for COVID losses. But $42 billion, I mean, it was laughed at across the country.
Right. And so eventually, of course, you know, those same states were strict. The lockdowns continued. You had other states opening up eventually, you know, the Floridas and the other states that were saying, "Hey, we're going to protect our economy. We're going to protect livelihoods as well as lives." And so that was a big deal. And that can't be ignored. And so now let's keep going to Illinois, because, you know, how does this play out? It's not just the beef prices and the gas prices. One of the things that everybody knows and struggles with, those who live in Illinois, is that we have the second highest property taxes in the country. Our property taxes are at least double, if not more, than what they are in Indiana and Kentucky. So it matters a lot. Well, guess what's in most counties that in Illinois, and the ones that, you know, the largest share of population, is there's something called PTEL, which is some fancy word. I'm not even tell you what it stands for, but basically that allows local governments who are subject to this law, they're allowed to raise their property taxes by the lower of inflation or 5%. Well, when inflation is 7% and more, well, guess what? Your property taxes are automatically, let me say this differently. Cities and governments are able to raise their total tax levy by 5% now. And so that means that overall, on average, property taxes are going to go up by 5%. And, you know, the other side of this whole property tax thing is home values. If you look at home values over the last, you know, decade, we're the fifth worst in the country for home values. And they're negative when you adjust for inflation. So more property taxes, 5% higher, and already bad home values, and a depressed Illinois relative to other states, it means more pain. And this is why we're so critical, because we're not critical to be critical. We're critical because people are getting hammered in Illinois. If they're not getting hammered by inflation, they're getting hammered by less job opportunities, higher gas taxes, higher property taxes. And here you go. We're going to get hit by this inflationary thing, which will creep into your property tax bill.
Yeah. And, you know, Chicago actually has a portion of its property taxes already going up automatically now every year with inflation. Chicago taxpayers just suffered an increase because of that. That was before this new round of inflation kicked in. So, you know, we'll have to see how big it's going to be next year based on these bad numbers.
Yeah. I mean, rather than governments, you know, having to justify why they want more, you know, can they find a way of becoming more efficient? They just get automatic increases. And that, of course, you know, people aren't getting automatic increases. Public sector workers get automatic increases, but not ordinary people. So this is a big pain. The other way this thing flows into Illinois is our public sector contracts. You've heard us talk recently, and we've written about it in our big article in the Wall Street Journal, is that You know, our unions have among the most power in the country. The labor laws in Illinois are so union friendly, so anti ordinary people, that those costs keep skyrocketing. Well, guess what? You can bet that when the next contracts come due, whether it's the Chicago Teachers Union or the police, fire, the AFSCME, they will all look at their contracts and look at inflation and say, and this is what Mark was talking about earlier, the expectations. They're going to say, we want more money. And you can imagine everybody will do that, because this is what's so bad about inflation is everybody wants more money. And so expect that to raise the cost of government, which means tax hikes later. It means, again, another way of flowing into the property taxes. It's insidious, and it's really hard to get out of. And it will be worse only because the Illinois public sector unions have so much power. They will squeeze it out of our politicians. And that's a sad thing. And that's one of the things that needs to be reformed in Illinois, is giving power back to the ordinary people and less power for the unions.
You know, what's the common denominator in all this? I mean, I'm sitting here trying to think of any element of the cause of this that's not the government's fault. Well, the pandemic was not the government's fault. Well, maybe some people might argue that. Depending on what happened in China and who funded it, we don't know for sure. The pandemic was not some of the mitigation measures that at least initially were widely agreed to. Consumers, irrespective of what the government told them, did cut back and stay home initially in the pandemic. But the rest of this, the causes of inflation, how we're handling it now, it's our own government destroying the country, and particularly city of Chicago, before our eyes. It's an astonishing thing in history, as far as I'm concerned. When you add in the other problems, I think that's a fair description. That would the country is being destroyed before our eyes by its own government.
Well, yeah, because it's hard to separate just inflation as some standalone thing. These are all interconnected to what's happened in, you know, if you bring up Chicago, a lot of this is it's really COVID policy, right? It's hard to blame the virus. And it showed up, right? We can try to play the blame game on China and all that, but that's a different argument. But it's here, and how we reacted to it has led to, it's like a chain reaction of events, right? Where we took away a lot of freedoms, where we federalized spending, we federalized a lot of the thought process on COVID, which led to fear, which led to, you know, the whole stuff that's happening in schools. It's led to more crime. You can, you know, blame the riots on it. It just goes on and on. And a lot of that is just failed public policy as a result of COVID, Mark. And it's scary where we are right now in our country, and certainly in a place like Chicago, which, you know, you talk to anybody who comes and visits Chicago in the past before COVID, one of their favorite cities to visit, and you know to visit it now.
You know, what are we going to do about it going forward? This is difficult because those underlying causes are already in place and are out there. A few things that are clear is that the Federal Reserve needs to wise up and start addressing inflation. In my opinion, at least, cut back on its monthly bond purchases. We need most of all to tell people to take the jobs that are available. I mean, still the most unusual thing about these times that's unprecedented, truly unprecedented, is the availability of jobs, good jobs, even in manufacturing, even in Illinois. Yet we have persistently high unemployment because people aren't taking those jobs. And instead, they're reliant on, you know, in part, government help. And the government is encouraging them to do that. You know, just this week, we've seen news stories about the city of Chicago proceeding to implement its guaranteed income program. Cook County has a guaranteed income program. Well, first of all, there's not going to be any funding for it come next year because the federal government is going to end its spigot, no doubt. But what kind of message are we sending people? You want to make them reliant on government at a time when we have an historic gap between the number of jobs that are available and the workers that are available. We have 11 million job openings, unprecedented, far more than the number of people who are unemployed. We just got to get people to take the jobs. And if that means maybe you have to move, maybe you have to move. Lots of people do that. That message is not getting out. Take the damn jobs. That should be the message from government.
Yeah, you know, and I think they will, Mark, once they run out of money. What's one of the things that we haven't discussed in our previous discussions is savings are at the highest level in forever. And so this kind of goes back to that whole thing that people got flooded with money. And until those savings run dry, many people are saying, hey, I don't want to go back to that job that I don't like, or I don't want to commute, or whatever it is. Or, hell, I know that I can do my work from home now. So it's going to take a while for that kind of restructuring of where jobs are and where people are. But just, you know, you're mentioning solutions, and that's certainly one of them. The other one is, you know, whatever happens in politics and you know, the next set of elections, we've got to get back in some way to pushing decisions back to lower levels of government, because I think the big issue has been this massive centralization and federalization of things. You know, once you start federalizing everything at the DC level, well, we lose control. There's also been massive control by states of local decisions. And it just totally brings everything out of whack. And, you know, Governor Pritzker's executive orders, we've been running Illinois 700 straight days on executive orders. No input from our legislature on all these COVID things. So the only way you can get back to some kind of normalcy is push those decisions back down, deregulate like crazy, and get back to an economy that that starts to work on price and, you know, and price discovery, because we're losing price discovery. We got to get back to some kind of normalcy. Otherwise, it's hard to figure out how we get ourselves out of this, I say.
Yeah, the core of that, of course, is that when you push power to the federal government, you're putting that power in the hands of the only institution in America that can create money out of thin air, at the Federal Reserve Bank. And, you know, they can borrow with reckless abandon, too. The bond market has been pretty comfortable with the level of borrowing being done by the Treasury. State and local governments cannot print money, and they've got some upside constraints that, you know, placed on them by the bond market and the rating agencies and everything else about how much they will borrow. You know, beyond the transparency and accountability that comes from local government, that's an important factor. Is there's a discipline of spending that comes from that, and they compete with each other. People are moving to the states that manage their affairs better, and that's the way it should be. That's the genius of the federal system that the founders created, and, you know, one of their brightest moments. And that's exactly what progressives want to undo for exactly those reasons. They want the power there in their hands at the federal level. And they've tried to do that in all kinds of ways, not with the, just with these new programs and the bailouts, but with, you know, the attempt to do that with Build Back Better and the, you know, attempt at least to rewrite voting laws and everything else according to a national standard that they would lay out. I think the tide is turning against them, but you know, the final outcome remains to be determined.
Yeah, Mark, I think the perfect way to end is what you said about competition. I've always loved that about America. You've got 50 states to choose from. Bad policies fail, good policies attract. And, you know, I keep arguing that Illinois has, all our legislators, government, have forgotten how to compete with other states. They think we're in an island, and, you know, we keep getting punished all the time with the people who leave Illinois, and places like Florida keep winning the people. They're winning the companies, the investments. So I think that's bottom line, is we've got to get back to a competitive mindset, and it's also a national competitive mindset. So that's all I've got, Mark. Any final comments on this important issue?
Nope, we'll stay on it. And a lot to cover. Ted, you know, our lives were a lot easier when we used to just talk about Illinois' problems, you know, particularly pensions and budgets and stuff. But the world has gotten far more complicated thanks to that federal nationalization of many of these issues. National issues have become Illinois issues to a lot much larger extent. So we got a lot of sleepless nights ahead of us, I'm afraid.
All right. Well, thanks, Mark. And thank you guys for joining and listening to us. And we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.